You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Zimbabwe faces overwhelming economic problems, constant political turmoil and violence, and in 2008 it was hit with a cholera epidemic. Join me now to look at why a former United Nations official is criticizing the UN's response to the cholera outbreak and what it says about the World Organization's approach is Elizabeth Dickinson, Assistant Managing Editor for Foreign Policy. Her article on the subject appears on foreignpolicy.com. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show today for our first underreported segment. Hi. Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Hi. Are you there? Elizabeth, you're on the air right now. We're speaking to you from Washington. Hello, Elizabeth?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, you haven't responded. Do we have a bad phone connection here? Let's start off with the most basic question. When did the cholera epidemic begin?
The cholera epidemic began in August of 2008. Some would say it began actually even a little bit earlier than that. Zimbabwe has these epidemics usually every year, but usually they're very concentrated in one or two areas. But this time, the epidemic was countrywide, and the extent of it was becoming very obvious by late summer.
I've heard that it's the first countrywide epidemic of cholera in modern history.
That's right. So usually, as I said, these cholera epidemics are in a few pockets. So you'll see one county maybe that has a particularly bad sanitation system have an outbreak. But in this particular case, it was the entire country, which says certainly something about, first of all, the conditions on the ground, but second of all, about the way that the response was handled.
And how many people were affected in the year that it lasted?
It was close to 100,000 by the end, and of that number, about 4,000 died, which is a mortality rate that is really unheard of with a disease like cholera, which is very easily preventable.
How did President Robert Mugabe and his government initially respond to this outbreak?
They denied it until December, early of December of 2008. This is nearly 4 months after the first cases were seen.
They denied it? Well, how can you deny something that is actually happening? Were they saying the hospitals weren't filled?
It was actually quite astonishing. Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, was on the radio in front of journalists saying, there's no cholera, there's no problem. This was at a time when the casualties were really starting to rack up. By November, December, when he was saying these things, there were already probably 5,000-6,000 cases on the ground and sort of in front of his eyes. You know, one of the ways that he was able to deny it was because the public health system had completely shut down. So you ask whether the hospitals were full. Well, they were, but they were full of bodies.
Well, what about aid organizations? I know the Mugabe government has regularly cracked down on journalists and activists. Have they also targeted international aid organizations?
They absolutely have. Beginning in June of that same year, so this is now 2 months before the cholera epidemic, the government placed a ban on all humanitarian aid from leaving the capital, which essentially meant that all of the organizations that were there to respond to a crisis like the cholera epidemic were trapped in Harare, in the capital. That ban was later lifted, but as I found out in writing this incredible story, is that some of the inhibitions still lingered, or some of the hesitancies about tackling this crisis still lingered for political reasons. There was a lot of fear on the ground that these aid organizations would be kicked out by Robert Mugabe if they failed to toe the line.
Now, why were they ignoring this terrible outbreak? Was there some kind of political consideration here, or? Obviously, it wasn't going to work for them PR-wise because word was getting out.
Absolutely. This is all about the situation that Zimbabwe found itself in 2008. So in June 2008, there were meant to be elections that would have pitted Robert Mugabe against his main opposition foe, who is Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of a group called the Movement for Democratic Change. Well, in the run-up to those elections, there was a great deal of violence. And in the end, Mugabe ended up retaining his power because the opposition pulled out. They said, there's just too much violence. We can't stay put. So Mugabe was already in a situation where he was extremely discredited from the outside. In the midst of that, he was very eager to portray himself as the leader of a country that was not in crisis. And we see that over and over throughout the course of the cholera epidemic. There is no cholera, he would say. We're tackling the problem, when he finally did admit it. This is clearly someone who has lost his grip on reality, but is extremely intent on retaining his grip on power. By not acknowledging the cholera epidemic, he was able to literally ignore it and pretend that this was not a political issue that could affect him in any way.
Well, when the cholera broke out, the inflation rate in Zimbabwe was 11.2%, which seems almost impossible. Unemployment was around 90%. And the UN estimated that 75% of the population needed food aid, and 4 million people had fled the country.
That's right. I mean, the situation was absolutely astonishing. I spoke to someone at the time, I remember, who told me that when you were having a meal in a restaurant in Harare, the price would change between the time you ordered it and the time when your meal finally arrived. So, absolutely, the country was, in general, in complete and utter disarray. This really says something about the leadership under Robert Mugabe up to that point. Here's a leader who let the inflation become completely out of control. It was exacerbated by some of the moves that he made, absolutely, and the way that he handled the central bank, and which is led by a very close ally of his. In short, Zimbabwe really crumbled in 2008, which is why this cholera epidemic was able to get so out of control.
Well, I mentioned the UN. Hadn't the Mugabe government been upset in 2005 by an assessment by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, which estimated that 700,000 Zimbabweans had been displaced by their own government?
Well, that's right, and that's really the backdrop to all of this. So back in 2005, when Mugabe really started to clamp down on rule in his country, he organized a number of slum-clearing exercises. So basically what that entailed was his forces going through neighborhoods and literally demolishing people's homes while they were still in them. Well, the United Nations sent a special rapporteur to come to Zimbabwe and report on what had taken place. That report was absolutely scathing. It placed responsibility with the government of Robert Mugabe for these displacements, and it really tainted the relationship between Robert Mugabe and the United Nations. Now, that while that special rapporteur left Mugabe, the United Nations still remained in the country, and through all the way up through 2008 and even still today, there is a lingering sort of distrust between the United Nations and the humanitarian wing. What we see that's most alarming is, although the United Nations humanitarian wing, and particularly that organization's country head, a man by the name of George Tadonki, warned of the cholera epidemic, warned of the election violence, those warnings were stifled, it appears, by other members within the United Nations to maintain a working relationship with Robert Mugabe, something that was already in jeopardy.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Dickinson, Assistant Managing Editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, about the UN's response to cholera in Zimbabwe as part of our first underreported segment today. So how long had George Tadonki, who is at the center of your story, been in Zimbabwe when this whole thing occurred?
George Tadonki arrived in Zimbabwe in March 2008, so that's about 3 months before the election violence began and about 6 months before the cholera epidemic began.
And the other major figure here is Agostino Zacharias. He was the UN's country director in Zimbabwe. How long had he been there when the cholera outbreak began to look serious?
That's right. Mr. Zacharias had been in the country since about 2005. He came to the country after several other offices within the United Nations, and several people that I spoke to also mentioned his very interesting past in Mozambique, where he was a former member of a rebel group there called Frelimo. Frelimo later came into the government in Mozambique, but it retained very close ties with the government of Robert Mugabe. This was sort of another backdrop to what was going on, is that many people believed, and whether it was true or not, the perception certainly was prevailing, that Mr. Zacharias, who was head of the United Nations in Zimbabwe, was inordinately close to Mugabe.
Well, there have been any number of reports of support for Mugabe throughout Africa. because people see him as one of the pioneer freedom fighters that has colored the relations with South Africa's government, hasn't it? So would Zacharias have been all that different, or was the fact that he was part of this rather destructive guerrilla movement for Limo, would that have colored his perception of what was going on?
I think both are absolutely right.
How would the UN even appoint somebody like that?
It's a very good question. You know, people that we talked to within the United Nations, first of all, had trouble speaking with us on the record because, of course, this is very difficult. But those we spoke to on background told us that one of the reasons that Mr. Zacharias stayed in his position so long, and perhaps even that he was appointed, was because he was effective at working with the Mugabe government. That is to say, maybe his proximity, that they would maintain, was able to achieve some things. Now, you have to ask yourself sort of at what cost. You know, maybe you're able to secure a few concessions with Mugabe because you're old friends or because you have some sort of mutual respect. But then in a case like cholera, it really works the other way. If you're too close, then you find yourself in the odd position of having to toe the dictator's line.
And what was George Tadankey's background?
George Tadankey had worked for the United Nations for about a decade. He had a number of really interesting posts. The man is actually something of a genius in mapping and monitoring. I was able to see some of his past work. He, among his most interesting positions in the past, he worked in Iraq prior to the Iraq War as a humanitarian coordinator there, monitoring some of the needs that were on the ground.
Was the working relationship between Tadankey and Zacharias troubled from the start?
I think it absolutely was, and I think within days probably of Tadankey's arrival, he understood, or he's told me that he understood, this proximity between Mr. Zacharias and Robert Mugabe. One very sort of blatant example, Mr. Zacharias blamed the agricultural problems, the food shortages, on, you know, droughts, the typical things that you would see in the region. Well, it turns out that Robert Mugabe has been expropriating land. He's been taking land from very productive farmers for years, and this has rendered the country's food production system absolutely, it's distraught. And a country that used to feed not only itself but the entire region is now dependent on food aid. That's something that's very political in nature, but for years it had been portrayed in UN reports that Mr. Zacharias had filed as something that was practically climactic.
Did others at the mission have trouble with Zacharias, or were they more concerned about Tadankey?
It seems from what I can tell that there was a real split in the country team on the ground, which of course couldn't have been helpful in a time of great crisis as the year of 2008 certainly was. It appears that there were certainly people on the ground who were concerned about Mr. Zacharias' proximity with Mugabe. It appears also that there were some who did believe that maintaining that quote-unquote working relationship with Mugabe was something that could benefit UN efforts.
And then Tadankey sent an early warning assessment to the head of OCHA about the team in Zimbabwe in March 2008. What did it say?
He basically wrote to New York and said, listen, guys, the team on ground is not ready for what's coming. By this point, by the time he sent this early warning, we're talking about April 2008, so 2 months before the electoral violence started. Mr. Tadankey warned about that. He warned about the coming crisis in the political system. And he said explicitly that the UN country team basically doesn't know what's coming, or they're not prepared to accept what's coming. He told me that he was worried that no one really understood the level of violence that Mugabe was ready to unleash against the opposition. And what he predicted really came into fruition. Between May and mid-June of 2008, the political violence in Zimbabwe was absolutely astounding. There's an incredible story of some of Mugabe's thugs going literally from house to house among the opposition and cutting off people's fingers. Because in Zimbabwe, the way that you vote is by making a fingerprint on a ballot. And so they would say to families that they believed had voted for the opposition, let's see how you vote for the opposition in the future. If your hand is cut off, if your finger is cut off, how are you going to vote for them then? So the situation was it was unbelievable. And Jadonki had warned about that in April.
Elizabeth Dickinson, Assistant Managing Editor of Foreign Policy, is my guest on today's underreported segment, the first one, which is about the UN's response to cholera in Zimbabwe. We'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out more of the story and find out whether the UN can work any other way when it's in a troubled country, and whether this, working with somebody like Mugabe says something about the efficacy of the United Nations, which has come in for some very serious criticism over the past few years. Stay with us. We're back with Elizabeth Dickinson, Assistant Managing Editor for Foreign Policy Magazine. Her article on the subject of the UN's response to the cholera epidemic in Zimbabwe is in appears on foreignpolicy.com. And this is a major story, and yet it's got very little attention, Elizabeth. Do you know why?
Well, I think it has to do with certainly Zimbabwe itself, as you were just mentioning a moment ago, a country that really is quite important in the region, but perhaps doesn't get as much coverage as it could. You know, it's been disappointing to watch, actually, how little attention this has gotten, and specifically because this issue comes up again and again. We're seeing it sort of as the quintessential dilemma in countries like Zimbabwe, in countries like Burma, where you're dealing with a regime or with a dictator or with a government that is uncooperative. Should the United Nations maintain a relationship with that government, as it seems to have happened in Zimbabwe, or should they really speak out when things are wrong? Should they speak out when the government is really acting in a way that's harmful to its own citizens? That's sort of the quintessential dilemma of humanitarian intervention in countries like this, and it's sure to pop up again and again.
Well, the big debate is always whether you keep these countries engaged or whether you you pull out, you apply sanctions. I'm sure the UN feels that it's on the horns of a dilemma here.
That's exactly right.
Now, if I were to speak to people at UN headquarters here, would they be more sympathetic, do you think, to Donkey or to Zacharias?
You know, I think that they would understand the situation that both of them were in. Having said that, I think that clearly the fact that Mr. Zacharias was in his position for nearly half a decade certainly says something about, you know, the way that people in the United Nations in New York responded to his approach. They clearly thought that this was something that was worth maintaining, that this proximity, that this quote-unquote working relationship, once again, was something that, you know, that they wanted to keep up.
How did other aid organizations working in Zimbabwe see Zacharias? Because the UN partners with a bunch of NGOs there.
Well, one of the most interesting people that I spoke to for this particular story was a man by the name of Ed Schenkenberg, who works for an NGO based out of Geneva, but who came to Zimbabwe to investigate what was going on. Basically, what he did was to speak with all of the NGOs and all of the UN agencies on the ground, and the impression that he left with was clearly one that Mr. Zacharias was way too close to Mugabe, that he was impeding the response, and that there was really frustration with that.
But was he effective in dealing with the government? Wasn't Zacharias able to negotiate with the government to make it easier for aid organizations to distribute aid?
Absolutely. He did make some progress, and here we see the difficulty of this debate. So one example is, during this time when inflation was so high, as you mentioned, Mr. Zacharias was able to speak with his allies within the Mugabe government to allow aid groups to use dollars rather than the Zimbabwean currency to fund their operations. This is important because you have to remember that in a country where inflation is so high, you literally cannot procure services with the local currency. That is to say, if you're paying me in Zimbabwean currency, you can't buy anything because the inflation is so high. So that was certainly a success. Other people I spoke to pointed to the fact that Mr. Zacharias had worked with the government to eliminate this this ban on humanitarian aid that Mugabe imposed following the elections. Now, that one, I'll be honest, and this is my personal opinion speaking here, but I have to be more skeptical about that particular one, as it took nearly 2 months to lift that ban. And one has to wonder, you know, yes, there was a good solution in the end, but by that point, most of the damage had already been done.
What reason was given when George Tadankey was fired in January 2009?
He was fired for what seems to be a bad performance review that took place in November 2008. This is a very sort of thorny issue, and it's a little bit difficult to pick through the pieces of exactly what happened. According to Tadankey, though, what happened is that his warnings and his sort of standing up to Mr. Zacharias really led to this bad performance review. And something that I can attest to is the fact that in the past, Tadankey had glowing performance reviews. I was able to see some of those, and I know that they were very high marks. So it does seem odd that he was fired for poor performance after a decade of good work. The other thing to say about his departure was that it seems like it was very hurried. And that's, in fact, what an ongoing case of his in Nairobi is about, is the way that he was fired. It seems as if he was fired without really being given good notice, without being given this, you know, an explanation in writing. And that does look a little bit strange, particularly given the circumstances.
His appeal was heard last week in Nairobi. Do you know what was decided?
The appeal is still ongoing, so there's no decision yet. But we do know that what's happened so far in the court process is that there's very much an effort on, you know, on Tadankey's part to make known the story of what he says took place in Zimbabwe and the story of this UN operation gone wrong.
The European Union has just introduced new travel and financial sanctions against Zimbabwe, citing its inadequate progress toward a democracy. Is there much else that the world can do to put pressure on the Mugabe government, which just seems to thumb its nose at any threats?
Well, the situation now is actually quite frustrating. So what happened after this terrible year of 2008 is that at last, in early 2009, there was a deal to put together a coalition government. So this includes Mugabe, but it also includes the main opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change. Now, that government has actually had a fair amount of success. They've particularly made inroads in social services. Inflation has disappeared. They've really done some good work. But now the frustration, at least on the part of some of the members of that government that I've spoke to from the opposition, from the Movement for Democratic Change, is that they're being hampered by some of these sanctions. I know that this sounds really counterintuitive. You know, why on earth would you want to lift sanctions against a government that still includes Mugabe? But at the same time, because of this coalition government, there are a lot of ministers within there and ministries, for example, education, housing, health, that really need money, and they're simply not able to get it.
There have been reports about frustration within the UN about the response to Haiti, this report on Zimbabwe. I just received a press release from a women's organization claiming that the UN shut them out of shaping recommendations for the Commission on the Status of Women. Do cases like this provide more ammunition for those who are critical of the UN to begin with?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Haiti, first of all, because I think that comparison is really useful. What's happened in the aid response in Haiti is actually quite similar to what happened with the cholera response in Zimbabwe, where you see particular sectors in Zimbabwe's case, health, and in Haiti's case, you know, housing and really getting emergency supplies to these people just really falling through. So I think that definitely this case speaks to some of the greater structural difficulties that the UN has in responding to these sort of cases. Now, you know, having said all that, I don't want to be in the business of UN bashing, and that's not what this is about. This is about looking at the ways that the world is relying on the United Nations to go into the most difficult places and to clean things up, and looking at that and saying, here's what's effective, here's what's not, and let's all try to figure out something that maybe can work a little better. And one of the things that always gets ignored when the UN goes in is the political aspect. You know, we imagine that the UN is sort of this apolitical character that can go in and that can fix things, sort of somehow hovering above the minutiae on the ground. But we see over and over again, and this case in Zimbabwe is a perfect example, that that's simply not the case.
Elizabeth Dickinson is Assistant Managing Editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. We have a link to her article of the UN's response to the cholera epidemic in Zimbabwe on our show page at wnyc.org. Thank you so much for being on our first underreported segment today.
Thank you.